Morning. Is that volume okay? No? Not for me. Okay. They changed the speakers in here, so we're getting some feedback because the speakers were behind the microphone. So now they're beside, in front. Apparently that's going to make things better. One thing, Larry, at the beginning of the lecture chant, the stops on the small bell. So we've been, this is our fall study period time. And some of us during this small study period time have been reading a book of stories. This book of stories is called The Record of the Transmission of the Light. You can turn and face me if you like. You don't have to. You might get a crick in your neck if you go like that the whole time. So, The Record of the Transmission of the Light, and it's a book of stories that was written in the 13th century, and it was written about, it is a book of stories about teachers and students, Buddhist teachers and students, who, starting with Shakyamuni Buddha, the historical Buddha, up until the author's teacher's teacher. So it's this book of 53 stories about people who were living together in community, and they were living together and they were practicing together and they were studying the Buddha Dharma together. And so these are people that were really, they really devoted their entire lives to study of the way. This was their whole life. You know, I mean, they had to do things like we have to do, like eat and beg for food, or, you know, find some way to get food and so forth. But the main focus of their life was practicing together, living together, studying together. And so these stories are about a few. We have to assume that there's many, many more stories than are recorded in this book of wonderful interactions between teachers and students over the many centuries. But these stories were picked out because they represent, and they're stories about very well-known teachers who had many students and who perhaps did even more than most to exemplify and transmit this Buddha teaching. One of the interesting things about these stories is they hardly ever mention, I don't know that I've seen much mention at all, if any mention, of the actual practice of meditation, which is so essential. You know, they never say, you know, and then the group was sitting zazen together and doing such and such and such. You don't see that kind of thing mentioned. It's actually more just these stories about the interaction between the student and the teacher, something and some turning word that the teacher said that had a profound impact on the student and launched that student into his own capacity for turning the Dharma himself. According to the book, it seems like all the stories are about men. Like I say, there are many more stories that aren't recorded, but in this book, it seems to be the history of the male ancestors. So, you know, even though there's not so much mention of Zazen practice, we have to assume that it's just there. It's just like breathing air, right? We don't mention that we're breathing the air. Today I was breathing the air. I was filling my lungs with this good air that we have. You don't mention that, but it's always there in the background. And so for Zen practitioners, for Buddhist practitioners, this sitting practice, this meditation practice is assumed. It's always there in the background. It's the basis. So one of our Zen ancestors who's mentioned in this book, but whose story I haven't read yet, not in this anyway, the story about him in this particular book I have not yet read, but his name is Dogen, and he was he was one of the Japanese Zen ancestors, and he is famous for one thing, for saying, well, he's famous for saying many things, but one of the things he's famous for saying is, you know, to study the Buddha way is to study the self. So we have to assume that these teachers and students who were practicing together and who are represented in this book, one of the main things, their principal activity was studying the self. Studying the self in sitting meditation. And as we were doing this morning, studying the arising of thoughts and studying our capacity for letting go of thoughts and sitting, as we say, just sitting without fondly continuing thoughts. Thoughts rise, but can we sit without fondly continuing thoughts? So these students and teachers living together, practicing together, studying the self together, in that context, they began to see that their relationship to the self was changing. In other words, they, after a long period of study of the habits of this self, which include, first of all, a view that we have a self. That's one thing. They studied that. They studied that there's a view, that we have a view, that there is a self, there is an entity here. They studied that. And they studied all these adventitious habits of the self, like self-pride, self-love, self-aggrandizement. Our tendency to possess things, and you know, they didn't study these. This was some kind of like critical eye. Like, I need to get rid of these things. They just studied these things as they arise. And after a long period of studying the self in meditation and in discussion with their teacher, it seems like what happened and what these stories represent is that the student's relationship to the self began to change. And the understanding of the self began to widen and be not as limited as before, and not as identified with the habits of self-pride and self-love. But a new understanding came into view of a wider, more generous, more kind, more flexible, more at ease, more, I don't know, a bigger version than they had before. They didn't see themselves as limited as they once did. And how they came to see that is by looking and studying and constantly seeing the arising of a very limited, cramped view, of constantly seeing those kinds of limited, cramped views of the self arising, constantly seeing the selfish tendencies of the self arising, and somehow, without doing anything else, but simply observing and being in the midst of all these arisings, a wider view came into their understanding. And when that, as that wider view of the self began to present itself, these students and teachers of the way began to feel that sitting in the midst of that wider view and practicing in the midst of that wider view was the most essential, critical thing that they needed to do in their lives, and that they wanted to wholeheartedly devote themselves to calling forth, receiving that wider view of the self. This became essential activity, and so, you know, they stayed on. They didn't leave the community, or if they did leave the community, they went to another community and checked that out and checked out that teacher. So there was constant process of inquiry and refining and growing in awareness of this wider view of the self. So one of the things that is apparent in these stories that we're reading is that you see the various teachers and students trying to find language to express this wider view. In one of our stories, the student goes to his teacher and he says this realization is like a jewel. He says it's the best jewel in the world. Nothing surpasses this jewel. But then he says, but I have a question. Does this jewel have form, or is it formless? So the teacher says, perhaps rather enigmatically, he says, you understand that there is form and that there's formlessness. But he says, you don't understand that this jewel neither has form nor is it formless. And you don't understand that this jewel is not a jewel. Not a jewel. What was the teacher's name? I can't remember the teacher's name, but the student's name was Nagarjuna. What was the teacher's name? Jayata? Was it Jayata? I think so. I think it's Jayata. But anyway, the student is Nagarjuna. The one who asked the question, or who comes to his teacher and says, "This is the best jewel in the world." A jewel. You don't understand that this jewel is not a jewel.
It's not a jewel.
Jewel.
I'm curing the word mule for something.
Ah. Articulation is so important. So I'll kind of come back to this enigmatic answer that the teacher gives, or this enigmatic response that the teacher gives. But I just wanted to point out that the title of our book, the title of our reading is the Record of Transmitting the Light. A jewel is a vehicle that receives light and transmits light. Right? A jewel receives light and transmits light. But the beauty of the jewel is that it does nothing. Makes no effort to receive the light or transmit the light. It just sparkles, right? A jewel just sparkles. So I think this has something to do with our sitting practice. We receive in our sitting, we receive the light of consciousness, the light of awareness. We receive being alive and having consciousness. This is just like the jewel receiving light. And then the question, you know, for some of us is, what happens when we receive this light? Does it become a kind of black hole, that we receive but we can't sparkle, we can't shine, we don't feel that we have something that shines out of us. And so we could maybe think about that and about in our Zazen practice that we are receiving all the time the light of awareness, the light of consciousness. And we could think about just being very grateful for that. You know, just being quite grateful and just grateful for that, for receiving that light, and not feel like, you know, we have to necessarily do anything about that, but let our attention be on that receptive capacity, that receptive capacity. And if we can bring our attention to our receptive capacity for the light of consciousness, and we can hold it there a bit, and we can keep the thoughts at bay, then we will shine. This is the formula, this is the recipe for becoming a shining person, a shining, glittering, giving person. So there's some stories, you know, in our Zen tradition about there's a famous story about a tile. You know, the teacher comes to the student to the student, and he says, and the student's sitting zazen, and he says, you know, what are you doing there, sitting in zazen? What's the point there? And student says, I'm sitting in order to make a Buddha. So the teacher picks up a tile and he starts polishing it. And then the student asks him, what are you doing there? He says, I'm polishing this tile in order to make a mirror. So it's a very famous story, of course. And you know, we could apply that story to the story of this jewel. Like, we might think, if I would say to you, the point, you know, what we should be doing in our practice is polishing this jewel, so we can, you know, become transmitters of light. The Buddha ancestors would have a problem with me. They would think that I was a little off base there. You know, Buddha ancestors say that the jewel is already thoroughly polished, and there's no activity that we need to undertake to make it any brighter. Enlightenment is waking up to the reality of the non-obstruction of the pure light of consciousness. Waking up to the reality of the non-obstruction of the pure light of consciousness.
Where did that come from?
That came from me. It's in my talk here on the page. One of our Zen ancestors, Ajo, says this about the light of the jewel awareness. We have a song of the jewel awareness. But I'm sticking with Ajo right now. And this is what Ajo has to say about this light of the jewel awareness. He says, this light has never had any place of abode. Even when Buddhas appear in the world, it does not appear in the world. Even though they enter nirvana, it does not enter nirvana. When you are born, the light is not born. When you die, the light is not extinguished. It is not more in Buddhas and not less in ordinary beings. It is not lost in confusion, not awakened by enlightenment. It has no location, no appearance, no name. It is the totality of everything. It cannot be grasped. It cannot be rejected. Cannot be attained. While unattainable, it is in effect throughout the entire being. That's such an important line. While unattainable, it is in effect throughout the entire being. From the highest heaven above to the lowest hell below, it is completely clear, a wondrous, inconceivable light. You know, it's very easy for us to think we are very dull jewels. We might even reject the whole jewel metaphor. It's very easy to fall into thinking we are very dull. And feeling that way too. And, you know, this teaching is that even in the midst of the gloom and darkness of delusion, even in the midst of your gloom and darkness, the light of this jewel is still shining, is always shining. So it's kind of a mystical light. So the teacher, I wanted to go back to the teacher who said, that the student Nagarjuna didn't understand that this jewel. He didn't understand form and formlessness, or whether this jewel had form or was it formless. And I don't actually know what that guy was trying to get at when he said that. But here's my teaching, such as it is. My teaching is this jewel has both form and formlessness. It has form as precepts. It has form as the practice of the perfections. It has form as enlightened activity in this world. It has form as the basis of the enlightened, of enlightened activity in this world. It is the basis of enlightened activity in this world. And this jewel is formless. There's nothing. There's no requirement. There's nothing we need to do. In fact, the less we do, the very less we do, the more this formless light shines. It's always shining, but we're aware. The less we do, the more aware we are, the more healed we are, the more held we are, the more comforted we are, the more soothed we are. by the formless activity of this light. So that's what I would have said. Actually, Nagarjuna didn't say anything. He just said, the story just says, he heard these words and he was enlightened. He didn't even need to like cognize anything about it. He just heard these words and he was bathing in Dharma and he was enlightened. And then he went on to be a great teacher of the middle way. The story says, I'll get to your question in just a second, but I'm going to close this up. The story says, this jewel is the best jewel in the world. The Buddha ancestor urges us to take care of it, not neglect it. Don't neglect this jewel. It is the most precious jewel. It is the most essential activity. So, I wrote a small verse about this story. Would you like to hear it? Neither cut nor polished, the wish-fulfilling jewel brightly shines in a single setting, the receptive heart of one who practices the Buddha way. I think I already sent it in. I think I already sent it in.
Were you going to publish?
Yeah, it must not have.
Can you read last?
Oh, my verse?
Yeah.
Neither cut nor polished, the wish-fulfilling gem brightly shines in a single setting, the receptive heart of one who practices the Buddha way.
Heart. I thought you said heart.
Our articulation is so important. No,
we want to hear something, and it's not what you're saying. So.
I know. I think in my dotage here, I tend to slur my words a little bit. So, excuse me for that. So. Would you keep track of the time? I forgot to bring a watch. How are we doing? When's the talk supposed to end? Oh, there's time for one question. Or two. Jeff?
There seems to be a metaphor for...
Yes.
Yes.
The jewel is maybe a metaphor also for value and permanence, perhaps. When we think of jewel, I often think of something that's long-lasting. I know the metaphor used with light is this light, and I'm paraphrasing, is inextinguishable, is what I think I gathered from that. So it's an unusual kind of light, or it's a kind of light that pervades all things. But also I think the jewel is a metaphor, is a lesson in impermanence and permanence. And even a jewel is a jewel for not forever. It will become something else, perhaps, before too long. So I wonder if that's not part of the lesson, is it a jewel and it is not a jewel, and that isn't that the case with all things, that we are and are not what we perceive them to be? Is that a question? Did I voice that as a question?
Well, this jewel, you kind of try to this jewel contains the whole Buddha Dharma as you're kind of presenting it there, you know, is a, and you're, I think you're right on all counts, including value. You know, it's the best. It's the best jewel in the world. It's the most precious jewel. But, you know, in our Zazen practice, it doesn't have any form. It can't be grasped. It can't be held onto. It's very difficult even, you know, to glimpse. You know, it has no exchange value, exactly. You know, it has intrinsic value, and you know, I don't know if it's a jewel that one can give to another, but one aspires to think that one could give this formless jewel to another, or give it to many people. So, you know, the jewel is, you know, when we want to marry someone, you know, we give them a jewel, you know. So there's something we're trying to say there. We're trying to convey this sense of how precious we feel that person is. And, you know, but this jewel of practice is, you know, it's just not limited to one person. It's limited to all beings. We want to give this jewel to everybody. We want everybody to have it. And we want to give away a myriad, thousand, million diamond rings. So it's that kind of expansiveness, and then, but it's, It can't be grasped. It can't be held on to. Raphael, do you need to leave? If you do, it's okay. Okay.
So I have two questions about the book. So those two questions are: The group of people, the teachers and the students who these stories are based on, was that just one group of people, or do the stories extend beyond generations of other groups of students and teachers?
Well, if I understand your question, it goes, this is a Zen master in late 13th century Japan looking back at the history of Zen transmission, or what he imagined Zen transmission looked like. And there's some, you know, as far as historically, you know, there's some problems with his imagination. But he's looking back through India, through a group of teachers and students in India, a group of teachers and students in China, and then a few in Japan, starting with Dogen. And Dogen's student Ejo, who we're gonna for our ending chant for this day, we're gonna experiment with a text by Ejo, who was Dogen's number one disciple in Japan. So anyway. It's that group. It's that lineage, and this particular lineage is the one that I am heir to as a Zen priest. You know, I'm not really in the lineage because I don't have Dharma transmission, and all these people in this book would have Dharma transmission. But even in our tradition, even like a person who gets lay precepts, become, in a sense, a lineage holder of this long lineage. And there were 53 generations represented in this book. And now, like, my teacher, I think, is the 92nd. And then Myo, I think, is the 93rd generation. And so forth. So this is still sort of being, you know, this is still being carried on as a tradition in Zen practice. Yeah.
Is it 93rd from Dogen or from Shakyamuni?
From Shakyamuni, yeah.
Thank you. The second question was that you said that the stories were based on interaction between the teacher and the student. Were there any stories that were had impacts from a student impacting another student, is what I was wondering.
There are many stories like that in Zen, you know, in the Book of Serenity. There's quite a few stories of Dharma brothers having interactions and, you know, not but sort of being as equals. There's many stories like that. But this particular rendition, it's always teacher to student, teacher to student. Showing, trying to demonstrate how this light has been transmitted unbroken from Shakyamuni to us. So this is, you know, this is a way one can think about it. Another way one can think about it is that, you know, this light is refracted, you know, throughout, you know, the Buddha Dharma, and it is landing all over the place, you know. Yeah, it's just refracted like those balls that they put up in a disco or something like that, and it spins the light, you know, in all directions. It's sort of like that. That's another way of it can be thinking. Actually, and that's the way the Chinese thought about it. The Chinese thought about it. This Dharma is just like, you know, there's lots of branches and many enlightened disciples and the lineage looks like a tree with many sub branches. But in this particular presentation, it's more linear. It's more like one to one to one to one. As a way of talking about this particular transmission that is Dogen's transmission, you know, his line trying to, and, you know, there was kind of at the time that he wrote this, I mean, he was Barry and I were talking about this the other day, Kazon was a great, who wrote the book, who gave the lectures that are the basis of the transmission of the light, he was a great, what would you call him, like a religious proselytizer or developer. I mean, he established many, many monasteries in the Soto Zen lineage, such that Soto Zen is still the biggest Buddhist sect in China, in Japan.
Is his name well known in Japan?
Oh, yeah. I mean, in Zen. I don't know about in Japan, but, you know, Kazon is a very famous figure. But it's... Yes, I mean there are those that would argue that was part of his polemical purpose. That was part of his polemical purpose in presenting it this way. Thank you for joining us today, Raphael.
Well, and also the liberties, were there liberties taken or the implication that liberties are taken in claiming this as a patriarch and another lineage might think. Was there any divisiveness with lineages at that time or subsequently that were aware
of? Sorry, I was totally distracted by the people that are leaving. And maybe we should... you should repeat your question and maybe that'll be the last one.
Yeah, I can.
No, go ahead.
I'm wondering if...
There is any suggestive, well, I'll give an example. When I told a good friend about this, he said, so all of these patriarchs are claimed by this particular writer, as if, you know, it would be an expectation that many other lineages kind of branch off of that same lineage, I think. And was there any controversy at that time or subsequently in Kazon's developing this lineage and claiming it as the legitimate Soto lineage?
I'm not aware of that. But yeah, I would guess there was that would be.
At least in the introduction to Transmission of the Light, there is a speculation anyway, that after Dogen, a lot of his teachings sort of went into disarray, and this was Kazan's attempt to reestablish the authenticity of Dogen's work by going back. So there must have been some kind of controversy going on.
Yeah, there was. Yeah, they discussed the fact that Tetsu Gikai was an abbot of Eheji, but then they got mad at him and he left. And yeah. Yeah, well, you know, his name's still on the roster, but he didn't get in the book. So yeah, there's that kind of. There may have been some purpose in that kind of thing.
There's political of, you know, who actually gets to control the assets. As far as like the lineage, like no one was saying like, no, you're not part of the lineage. You're
excluding anybody.
There wasn't that.
But of course, these aren't really the main points that I wanted to leave you with. The main point is, you know, to encourage you to engage the transmission of the light, to engage this wider version of the self, and rest there in zazen, and then that becoming the basis for your activity in the world, the generous basis, the light-giving, sparkling basis for your activity in the world and daily lives.